The tiny fragment of the ego, which is put down into the personality, is the point of consciousness which clairvoyants can see moving about in the man. According to one system of symbology, it is seen as the golden man the size of a thumb, who dwells in the heart. Others, however, see it rather in the form of a star, a brilliant star of light. A man may keep his star of consciousness where he will, that is to say, in any one of the seven principal chakrams or centers of the body. Which of these is most natural to a man depends largely upon his type or ray, and probably also upon his race and sub-race. Men of the fifth root race nearly always keep this consciousness in the brain, in the center dependent upon the pituitary body. There are, however, men of other races to whom it comes more natural to keep it habitually in the heart, the throat or solar plexus. The star of consciousness is thus the representative of the ego in the lower planes, and, as it manifests through the lower vehicles, we call it the personality, the man as he is known to his friends down here. Although, as we have seen, the ego is but a fragment of the monad, yet he is complete as an ego in his causal body, even when his powers are undeveloped, whereas in the personality there is but a touch of his life. Furthermore, whilst in the case of the ordinary man, the consciousness of the ego on his own plane is only partial and vague, yet so far as it is active, it is always on the side of good, because it desires that which is favorable to its own evolution as a soul. In fact, the never-changing desire of the ego is for progress, for the unfoldment of the higher self, and for bringing of the lower vehicles into tune as its instruments. Any of those thoughts that we call evil are for the ego impossible, for, in the ego, so far as any quality is developed, it is pure. If, for example, affection is there, page 193, it is utterly untainted by jealousy, envy or selfishness. It is a mirror of the divine love, insofar as the ego can reproduce it at his level. Furthermore, the ego is never likely to be wrong. He is, apparently, not deceived about anything, but that he is ignorant of certain matters is quite clear, for indeed the very purpose of incarnation is to remove that ignorance. But, as we have seen, the fragment of the ego, which has been put down into lower matter, becomes so, page 129, keenly and vividly conscious in that matter, that it thinks and acts as though it were a separate being. It forgets that it belongs to the less developed, but far wider consciousness of the ego, and sets up in the business of life on its own account, and tries to go as it wants, rather than as the ego wishes. Furthermore, the ego, with all his mighty powers, is very much less accurate than the lower mind, and the personality, valuing above all the discriminating powers of the lower mind which it is intended to develop, often comes in consequence to despise the far higher but vaguer self, and acquires a habit of thinking of itself as an independent ego. We may note here that all through the course of our evolution there is always a danger that a man should identify himself with that point at which, or that the vehicle in which, he is most fully conscious. Hence, as we have seen, sometimes it seems as though the fragment worked against the whole, but the man who is instructed declines to be deluded and reaches back through the keen, alert consciousness of the fragment, to the true consciousness behind, which is as yet so little developed. That is what Mr. Sinnett called giving allegiance to the higher self. We have already seen that in the nature of things, there can be no evil in the causal body, or in the ego. But wherever there is a gap in the causal body, there is a possibility that the lower vehicles may run into some sort of evil action. Thus, for example, the astral elemental may take possession of the man and rush him, page 194, into the commission of a crime. In such a case the ego is not sufficiently awake to step in and prevent the action, or perhaps he does not understand that the passion or greed of the astral body may force the lower self into commission of the crime. Evil, therefore, does not come from the higher self, it comes from a lack in the higher self, because, if the ego were more developed, he would check the man on the brink of the evil thought, and the crime would not be committed. In ordinary men, the ego has not much grasp of the personality, nor a clear conception of his purpose in sending it forth, and, as we have seen, the small piece which meets us in the personality grows to have ways and opinions of its own. It is developing by the experience it gains, and this is passed on to the ego. But, together with this real development, it usually gathers a good deal which is hardly worthy of that name. It acquires knowledge, but also prejudices, which are not really knowledge at all. It does not become quite free of those prejudices, be it noted, of knowledge, of feeling and of action until the man reaches adeptship. Gradually it discovers these things to be prejudices, and progresses through them, but it is always a great deal of limitation, from which the ego is entirely free. In order to assist the ego in controlling his vehicles and to help to utilize them for his own purposes, a very great deal can be done by parents and teachers, during infancy and childhood. For it makes a vast difference when the good, rather than the evil germs in the child's bodies are aroused first. If by exceeding care before birth, and for several years after it, the parents are able to excite only the good tendencies, then the ego will naturally find it easy to express himself along those lines, and a decided habit is set up in that direction. Then, when an evil excitation comes, it finds a strong momentum in the direction of good, which strives in vain to overcome. Page 130. Similarly, if the evil tendencies have been aroused first, page 195, then excitations towards what is good have to struggle against the predisposition towards evil. In this case, there is in the personality a taste for evil, a readiness to receive and indulge in it. In the other case, however, there is strong natural distaste for evil, which makes the work of the ego much easier. In the average man there is a perpetual strain going on between the astral and mental bodies, and also neither of these bodies is in the least in tune with the ego, or prepared to act as his vehicle. What is needed is the purification of the personality, and also the channel between it and the ego must be opened and widened. Until this is done, the personality sees everything and everybody from its own very limited point of view. The ego cannot see what is really going on. He perceives only the distorted picture of the personality, which is like a camera, with a defective lens, that distorts the light rays, and a faulty plate, which makes the result blurred, indistinct, and unequal. Hence, in the case of most people, the ego cannot derive any satisfaction from the personality, until it is in the heaven world. The ego himself knows the true from the false. He recognizes truth when he sees it, and rejects the false. But, generally, when he casts an eye downwards into the personality, he finds so crazy a confusion of inconsequent thought forms, that he can distinguish nothing definite. He turns away in despair, and decides to wait for the quietude of the heaven world, before attempting to pick up the fragments of truth out of this unseemly chaos. Under more peaceful conditions of devachan, as the emotions and thoughts of recent physical life come up one by one, and envisage themselves in the vivid light of that world, they are examined with clear vision. The dross is thrown away, and the treasure is kept. The disciple should, of course, try to bring about that condition, while still in the physical body, body purifying the personality, and harmonizing it with the ego or soul. Page 196. Although the ego is undoubtedly only very partially expressed by his physical body, yet it would be inaccurate to speak of him as dissociated from that body. If we imagine the ego as a solid body, and the physical plane as a surface, then, if the solid is laid on the surface, obviously the plane figure, representing the contact of the solid with the surface, would be an exceedingly partial expression of the solid. Further, if the various sides of the solid were laid on the surface successively, we might obtain impressions which differed considerably from one another. All of them would be imperfect and partial, because in all cases the solid would have an extension in an entirely different direction, which could in no way be expressed on the flat surface. In the case of an ordinary man, we shall obtain a nearly accurate symbolism of the facts if we suppose the solid to be conscious, only so far as it is in contact with the surface. Nevertheless, the results gained, through the expression, of such consciousness, would inhere in the solid considered as a whole, and would be present in any later expression of it, even though that might differ considerably from previous expressions. Page 131. When the ego is still undeveloped, he cannot respond to more than a very few of the extremely fine vibrations of the higher mental plane, so that they pass through him practically without affecting him. At first it needs powerful and comparatively coarse vibrations to affect him, as these do not exist on his own plane, he has to put himself down to lower levels in order to find them. Hence full consciousness comes to him at first only in the lowest and densest of his vehicles, his attention being focused for a long time in the physical plane, so that although that plane is so much lower than his own, and offers so much less scope for activity, yet in those early stages he feels himself much more alive when he is working there. As his consciousness increases, and widens its scope, he gradually begins to work more and more in matter, page 197, one stage higher, that is, in astral matter. At a much later stage, when he has attained to clear working in astral matter, he begins to be able also to express himself through the matter of his mental body. Still later, the end of his present effort is achieved when he works as fully and clearly in the matter of the causal body on the higher mental plane as he does now on the physical plane. When an ego becomes sufficiently developed to come under the direct influence of the master, the amount of that influence, which can be passed on to the personality, depends upon the connection between that personality and the ego, which is very different in different cases. There is, in fact, an infinite variety in human life. As the spiritual force rays upon the ego, something of it must flow through to the personality always, because the lower is attached to the higher, just as the hand is attached to the body by the arm. But the personality can receive only what it has made itself able to receive. There is also another important factor which comes into operation. The master often plays upon the qualities in the ego which are much obscured in the personality, so that, in such a case, very little comes down to the personality. Just as only those experiences of the personality can be handed on to the ego, which are compatible with the nature and interests of the ego, so only those impulses, to which the personality can respond, can express themselves in it. We must also bear in mind that whilst the ego tends to exclude the material, and receive the spiritual, so the general tendency of the personality, at least in the earlier stages, is to exclude the spiritual, and receive the material. A clairvoyant may sometimes see these influences at work. Thus, on a certain day, he may notice a characteristic of the personality much intensified, with no outward reason. The cause is often to be found in what is taking place at some higher level stimulation of that quality in the ego. A man may find himself, for, page 198, example, overflowing with affection or devotion, and quite unable on the physical plane to explain why. The cause is usually the stimulation of the ego or, on the other hand, it may be that the ego is taking some special interest in the personality for the time being. The relationship between a pupil and his master is not at all unlike that of the personality to the ego. Just as the ego may be considered to put down a small fragment of himself into the personality, and express himself, however imperfectly, through that personality, so in the same sort of way the pupil not merely, page 132, represents the master, but is the master in a very real sense. But the master under tremendous limitations. Those limitations consist, not only of the conditions of the lower planes themselves, but also, of course, of the personality of the pupil, which is by no means transcended. Furthermore, even if the pupil's ego had gained perfect control of his lower vehicles, there would still be the difference between the size of the ego of the pupil and of the ego of the master, because the pupil is naturally a smaller ego than the master whom he follows, and therefore can be only an incomplete representative of him. Meditation is a method of drawing the attention of the ego. It should, however, be borne in mind that, in the practice of meditation, instead of trying to interrupt the ego and draw him down to the personality, we should strive to reach up to him in his higher activity. Higher influence is certainly invited by meditation, which is always effective, even though on the physical plane things may seem to be very dull, and quite without zest. The feeling of dullness in the personality may, in fact, be due to the reaching upwards of the ego, and his consequent neglect to send energy down to the personality. Meditation and the study of spiritual subjects in this earthly life undoubtedly make a very great difference in the life of the ego. For meditation, conscientiously, page 199, done, opens the channel between the personality and the ego, and keeps it open. It should, however, be borne in mind that the physical meditation is not directly for the ego, but for the training of the various vehicles to be a channel for the ego. In fact, during physical meditation, the ego regards the personality much as at any other time. He is usually slightly contemptuous. Nevertheless, the force which comes down is always that of the ego, but as it is only a small part, it tends to give a one-sided conception of things. The ordinary person, who has not taken up spiritual matters seriously, has a thread of connection between the personality and ego. In fact, this channel is often so narrow that sometimes it appears to be almost choked up. On some special occasion, as, for example, that of conversion, the force may break through again. For more developed persons, there is a constant flow, in some measure, between ego and personality. These considerations should bring home to us that it is by no means always accurate to judge the ego by his manifestation in the personality. Thus, for example, an ego of an intensely attractive type may make more show, on the physical plane, than another of far higher development, whose energy happens to be concentrated almost exclusively upon the causal or buddhic levels. Hence, people who judge merely by physical plane appearances are frequently entirely wrong in their estimation of the relative development of others. Each of the successive descents of the ego into the lower planes is a limitation so indescribable that the man whom we meet down here on the physical plane is at best a fragment of a fragment, and as an expression of the real man is so inadequate as to furnish us with nothing even remotely resembling a conception of what that man will be at the end of his evolution. Until one can see the ego, one has no conception of how great he really is, how infinitely wiser and, page 133, stronger than the incarnate entity. Everyone, in reality, page 200, is very much better than he ever seems to be. The greatest saint can never fully express his ego, on that higher plane he is a still greater saint than he can ever be down here. But, magnificent as he is still, if we may say so, vague in his magnificence. There are really three ways in which the ego may be developed, and may influence the life. 1. The way of the scientist and philosopher. These develop not only the lower mind, but also the higher, so that a great deal of its more abstract and comprehensive kind of thought comes down into their consciousness. For such as these, the development of the buddhic consciousness will come later. 2. The method of using the higher emotions, such as affection, devotion or sympathy, and so awakening the buddhic principle to a great extent without developing especially the intermediate causal body. Nevertheless, the causal body will be affected, since all buddhic development reacts very powerfully on the causal body. These people are not necessarily developing a buddhic vehicle in which they can permanently live, but the use of the higher emotions unquestionably evokes vibrations in the buddhic matter. Hence there is a stir in the as yet unformed buddhic vehicle, so that many of its vibrations come down and brood over the astral body. Thus the man may receive a considerable amount of influence from the buddhic plane before the vehicle is at all fully developed. 3. The more obscure method in which the will is called into activity, the physical body in some way reacting on tmic matter. Very little is known as to how this operates. The method of most students is through devotion and keen sympathy with their fellow men. A fairly advanced ego may sometimes be rather inconsiderate of his body because whatever is put down into the personality means so much taken from the ego, and he may therefore grudge such expenditure of force. An ego may be somewhat impatient, and withdraw himself somewhat from the personality. In such cases, however, page 201, there would always be a flow between the ego and personality, which is not possible with the ordinary man. In the ordinary man, the fragment of the ego is, as it were, put down, and left to fend for itself, though it is not completely cut off. At the more advanced stage mentioned, however, there is a constant communication between the two along the channel. The ego can therefore, withdraw himself whenever he chooses, and leave a very poor representation of the real man behind. So we see that the relations between the lower and higher self vary much in different people, and at different stages of development. An ego busy with his own occupations on his own plane may forget for a time to pay his personality proper attention, just as even a good and thoughtful man may occasionally, under some special pressure of business, forget his horse or his dog. Sometimes, when that happens, the personality reminds him of its existence by blundering into some foolishness, which causes serious suffering. One may notice that sometimes, after the completion of a special piece of work, that is needed the ego, page 134, operation of the ego to a large extent, as for example, lecturing to a large audience, the ego takes away his energy, and leaves the personality with only enough to feel rather dispirited. For a time, he admitted that there was some importance in the work, and therefore poured down a little more of himself, but afterwards he leaves the unfortunate personality feeling rather depressed. We must ever recollect that the ego puts down into the personality only a very small part of himself, and as that part constantly becomes entangled in the interests which, because they are so partial, are often along lines different from the general activities of the ego himself, the ego does not pay any particular attention to the lower life of the personality, unless something rather unusual happens to it. In the physical life of the ordinary man of the world, page 202, there is little of interest to the ego, and it is only now and then that something of real importance occurs, that may for a moment attract his attention, so that from it he draws whatever is worth taking. The ordinary man lives in patches, more than half the time he is not awake to the real and higher life at all. If a man complains that his ego takes very little notice of him, let him ask himself how much notice he has taken of his ego. How often, for example, in any given day, has he even thought of the ego? If he wishes to attract the attention of the ego, he must make the personality useful to him. As soon as he begins to devote the greater part of his thought to higher things, in other words, as soon as he really begins to live, the ego will be likely to take somewhat more notice of him. The ego is well aware that certain necessary parts of his evolution can be achieved only through his personality, in its mental, astral and physical bodies. He knows, therefore, that he must some time attend to it, must take it in hand, and bring it under his control. But we can well understand that the task may often seem uninviting, that a given personality may appear anything but attractive or hopeful. If we look at many of the personalities around us, their physical body full of drugs and poisons, their astral bodies reeking with greed and sensuality, and their mental bodies having no interests beyond money-making, and perhaps sport of the cruder varieties, it is not difficult to see why an ego, surveying them from his lofty height, might decide to postpone his serious effort to another incarnation, in the hope that the next set of vehicles might be more amenable to influence than those upon which his horrified gaze now rests. We can imagine that he might say to himself, "I can do nothing with that, I will take my chance of getting something better next time, it can hardly be worse, meantime I have much more important business to do up here." A similar state of affairs not infrequently happens, page 203, in the early stages of a new incarnation. As we have already seen, from the birth of the child the ego hovers over it, and, in some cases, begins to try to influence its development while it is still very young. But, as a general rule, he pays little attention to it until about the age of 7, by which time the work of the karmic elemental should be practically finished. Page 135, but children differ so widely, that it is not surprising to find that the relation between the egos, and the personalities involved, differs widely also. Some child personalities are quick and responsive, some are dull and wayward. When dullness and unresponsiveness are prominent, the ego often withdraws his active interest for the time, hoping that, as the childish body grows, it may become cleverer or more responsive. To us such a decision may seem unwise, because, if the ego neglects his present personality, it is unlikely that the next will be an improvement upon it. And if he allows the child body to develop without his influence, the undesirable qualities which have been manifested may quite possibly grow stronger, instead of dying out. But we are hardly in a position to judge, since our knowledge of the problem is so imperfect, and we can see nothing of the higher business, to which the ego is devoting himself. From this it will be seen how impossible it is to judge, with any precision, the position in evolution of anyone whom we see on the physical plane. In one case, karmic causes may have produced a very fair personality having an ego of only moderate advancement behind it. In another case, those causes may have given rise to an inferior or defective personality, belonging to a comparatively advanced ego. When the ego decides to turn the full force of his energy upon the personality, the change which he can produce is very great. No one who has not personally investigated the matter cannot imagine how wonderful, how rapid, how radical, such a change may be, when conditions are favorable, that is, when the ego is, page 204, reasonably strong, and the personality not incurably vicious, more especially, when a determined effort is made by the personality, on its side, to become a perfect expression of the ego, and make itself attractive to him. To understand how this can be, it is, of course, necessary to look at the matter simultaneously from two points of view. Most of us here are very emphatically personalities, and think and act exclusively as such, yet we know all the time that in reality we are egos, and those of us who, by many years of meditation, have rendered ourselves more sensitive to finer influences, are often conscious of the intervention of the higher self. The more we can make a habit of identifying ourselves with the ego, the more clearly and sanely shall we view the problems of life. But, in so far as we feel ourselves to be personalities, it is obviously our duty, and our interest, to open ourselves to the ego, to reach up towards him, and persistently to set up within ourselves such vibrations as will be of use to him. At least we should be sure that we do not stand in the way of the ego, that we always do our best for him, according to our lights. Since selfishness is the intensification of the personality, the first step should be to rid ourselves of that vice. Next, the mind should be kept filled with high thoughts, for, if it is continually occupied with lower matters, even though those lower matters may be quite estimable in their way, the ego cannot readily use it as a channel of expression. When the ego makes a tentative effort, when he puts down, as we might say, an explanatory finger, he should be received with enthusiasm, and his behests should be instantly obeyed that he may more, and, page 136, more take possession of the mind, and so come into his inheritance, so far as the lower planes are concerned. The personality should, so to speak, stand aside, and let the ego, the warrior, fight in him. In so doing, however, the personality must take care, page 205, that he is devoted to the work, and not to his personal share or part in it. He must take care that, in a rush of personality, he remembers all the time that it is the ego that is working in him. Although the vagueness of the ego, unless he were developed, may perhaps preclude him from indicating a particular line of work, yet when the personality, being more definite, has found the work, the ego can and does pour himself down into it, and enables him to do it in a much better manner and in an altogether grander frame of mind than the personality could attain unaided. But if thou, the personality, look not for him, the ego, if thou pass him by, then there is no safeguard for thee. Thy brain will reel, thy heart grow uncertain, and in the dust of the battlefield thy sight and senses will fail, and thou wilt not know thy friends from thy enemies. Light on the path, this is what happens when the personality does not look for the higher guidance of the ego. This is a step necessary to be taken. But man who intends to set his feet upon the path which leads to initiation, for, at initiation, the lower and the higher become one, or rather the lesser is absorbed by the greater, so that there should be nothing left in the personality, which is not a representation of the ego, the lower being merely an expression of the higher. With this, however, we shall deal more fully in chapter 31, which deals specifically with initiation. It is obvious, therefore, that the personality should endeavor to ascertain what the ego desires, and provide him with the opportunities he wants. The study of inner things, as mentioned, and living the spiritual life, wakes up the ego, and attracts his attention. To take an example, suppose you have an ego whose principal method of manifesting himself is by affection.